so very thankful that once again we have this opportunity to come together and learn more of your word this evening. We're ready to be with Rex and help him to have a quick and great recollection of what he studied and help him to relate things to us in such a way that we are easy to understand. And help each one of us pay diligent attention and endeavor to understand your word and life and things that we're in our lives. We thank you for so many things.
Amen. Okay, we are in chapter 53. Yeah, right. There aren't 53 chapters in the book of Numbers, so we're definitely not in 53. We're in chapter 23. We're going to hopefully get through that quick. We're going to end the story that we started last week. Who were we looking at last week? Who were the two main characters? Balaam and Balak. Okay. And Balak was who? He was the king of Moab. He was the king of Moab, and he allied himself with what other tribe? Moses' stepfather, or Moses' father-in-law? Midianites, okay? He was the priest. Jethro was the priest of the Midianites. And so we see those two tribes are together, and the tribe that they're particularly focused on is Israel. Why was that a problem for Balak? What did Balak ask Balaam to do?
Curse
them. You come down and curse these people. Okay, why? Yeah. He was afraid of them. Okay, he was afraid of them. Keep in mind that Israel had already gone to two nations and said, please let us pass through. And both of those nations had said, sure, no problem, right? No. Okay. Didn't say that. Because who was with Israel?
God.
And it was very evident God was with Israel because everybody knew about what major event, what major miracle. The Red Sea, okay? Leaving Egypt, crossing the Red Sea. They may not have all known that Israel did it on dry land, but they knew Israel had come out going across the Red Sea. I mean, that's, you know, if that happens somewhere, if some kind of event, like, it's kind of like having a volcano. Well, speaking of volcanoes, Mount St. Helens blowing up in your backyard, okay? That's a momentous event. That gets people's attention. Well, this got people's attention too. And so this people that's come out of Egypt, okay, he's afraid that they're going to come in and take away his land. He's the king, he's the boss man, and that's what he's afraid of. And keep in mind that he has some knowledge of these people because they're, what's their relationship familiarly? They're cousins, yes. Don't be shy. It's going to be another one of those nights I can see. Don't be shy. Just, you know, spit it out. You can't be wrong. There are no wrong answers. Okay? So we see the Balak is called Balaam to come south. Balaam is from Aram. And Aram today would, somebody that lived in Aram would be living in what nation? Somebody said it.
Syria.
Okay? Yes. Okay, would be the nation of Syria, and Balak himself was from Moab, which was south and east of what today we would think of as Israel, Jordan, that area over in there. Okay, so that's who we're talking about. We're talking about these people. So what is it that Balaam wants? We know that Balak wants Israel cursed. What is it that Balaam wants? Why is he willing to do this? What has Balak told him? Yeah, you're going to get a lot of money, okay? And because apparently, as most I've got to be careful what word I used here. As most people who have special powers, because Balaam did. I mean, he'd been using them. That's how he got his reputation. Okay? And so he wants this money from Balak. That's really amazing, isn't it? That a human being would want money from another human being? Come on, folks, loosen up. This is so typical, okay? So he wants to get this reward, whatever the reward is, okay? So Balak sends one group of representatives to him, okay? And what is Balaam's answer? What does he tell him that God's told him? Because he goes to talk to God. Okay, but he said, what? You will not?
No.
Well, actually, well, maybe, yes, I think you're right, the first time, okay? He said, you won't go and you won't do what? You will not curse Israel, okay? You're not going to curse Israel. And then he sends another more highfalutin, as we might say, I've been reading Westerns, that's why I came up with that term. More impressive, someone to speak to Balaam for him, and Balaam really wants to go. Okay, and who does he go talk to? He goes and talks to God again. You didn't like the answer the first time? Okay, well, maybe God will change his mind. We're going to get into that in just a few minutes. Okay, so he goes and talks to him again. Balaam, or God, tells him again, okay, you can, what could he do? You could go, okay, but you're not going to be able to curse Israel, okay? And so we find them as we begin chapter 23, if you look at 22:41, then it came about in the morning that Balak took Balaam and brought him up to the high places of Baal, and he saw from there a portion of the people. What's a high place? What is he talking about? I'm sorry?
Elevation.
Yes, elevated. It's a mountain. Okay? Keep in mind that Israel is down on the plain. Okay, and surrounding the plain, what do you normally have? Mountains, higher ground. Okay, so they're in this place that's called, in verse 41 of chapter 22, it's called the high place, high places of Baal. And what's interesting, this is the first time, as they're up there, that Balaam actually sees Israel and the camp of Israel. And that's where we begin in chapter 23. And so, in verse 7, okay, from Aram Balak has brought me, that is Balaam speaking, Moab's king from the mountains of the east. Come curse Jacob for me, and then denounce, and come denounce Israel. And in verse 8, Balaam says, how shall I curse whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce whom God has not denounced? Balaam has already told Balak what? I can't do it, okay? I cannot say anything but what God tells me to say. Okay, that's what he says. And so he has seen Israel, and so we get over to about verse 13 through 18 in chapter 23, and what does Balaam or Balak ask there? Verse 13. Yeah, please come with me to another place from where you may see, and although you will not only see the extreme end of them, you will not see all of them. Keep in mind, the camp is pretty big. There's 2 million people in the camp, somewhere between 2 and 3 million. And so it's a good-sized camp. And so in verse 14, so he took him to the field of Zophim, to the top of Pisgah. What's Pisgah? It's another mountain, okay? So it's another mountain that he takes him up to, and he gets another view of Israel. okay? And then if we look in verse 16, then God is speaking to Balaam. Balaam's gone in and talked to him because Balak, you know, they go through this whole rigmarole in verses 13 through 15. They create these seven altars and they do all of these things, and it's very elaborate and it's so expansive. It just sounds like something that God would really appreciate, right? When Jacob came back, what did he use for an altar when he came back from his trip to get his wife? I'm sorry? A stone. Okay. What did he call it? He called it an altar. That's what God called it. God called it an altar. Okay. And God, it's really interesting, but if you think about it, all of the pagan religions that we read about in the Bible, and unfortunately that trend has tended to continue up to the present day, they have this elaborate procedure that they go through, all this elaborate stuff that they do, okay? And other than the temple, okay, what do we see God doing? Does he have all of this elaborateness in his worship to him? Is that what he's looking for? The correct answer to that question, folks, if it went right over the top of your heads, is no, that's not what he's looking for. What's he looking for? What's he looking for from us? Okay, how do we worship him? With what? With our heart, with our being, with what we do, with how we live. Okay, that's what he's looking for, and that's how he knows. You know, think about the lesson that we had Sunday from Mariano. Okay? If you don't live the faith, you don't have the faith. That's really what it's all about. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about religion here. So they're up at the top of Pisgah. He looks at this. They've got all of this going on. And God says to Balak through Balaam, verse 16, then the Lord met Balaam and put a word in his mouth and said, return to Balak, and thus you shall speak. Okay? He came to him, and behold, he was standing beside his burnt offering. That is, Balak was. And Balak asked him, what has the Lord spoken? And then he goes into this discourse in 18 through 24, and actually it extends beyond that, but there's some separation in there. But the interesting thing is what he says, arise, O Balak, and hear, give ear to me, O son of Zippor. Okay, God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. When he has blessed, then I cannot revoke it. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. Look at the difference in the attitude of man and God. What does man want to do? What did Balaam want to do in his relationship with God and Balak? Yeah, use it to his advantage. He wants to negotiate. You know, God, can we work this out? Can't you? He's already done that once, hasn't he? He talked to God a second time, and God said, okay, you can go, but you're not going to be able to give Balak what he wants. And if you can't give Balak what he wants, what is Balaam not going to get? He's not going to get the reward, okay? And Balak's going to talk about that. So Balak appeals to Balaam to at least not bless Israel. Verse 25, then Balak said to Balaam, do not curse them at all, nor bless them at all. But Balaam replied to Balak, did I not tell you whatever the Lord speaks that I must do? What choice did Balaam have? Did Balaam have a choice in what he said to Balak? Doesn't sound like it to me. This was not free will. Choose what you want to say. God gave him the words. These are the words that you're supposed to use. This is what you're supposed to tell him. And so then we see him where? In verses 27 through 30. They've already been to the first site, and then they went to the second site, which is, now I've already lost the Pisgah, the top of Pisgah. And now they're at a third site, okay? And this is the top of where?
Peor.
Okay, Peor is another mountain, or high hill, or whatever you want to call it. It certainly wasn't Himalaya-type mountain, okay? It was something you could walk to the top of, or climb to the top of. And then what I think is really interesting in chapter 24, verses 1 through 9, Balaam has what I think of as epiphany, okay? And when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not go as at other times and seek omens, but he set his face toward the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes and saw Israel camping tribe by tribe, and the Spirit of God came upon him. He took up his discourse. What discourse? The one he'd already been having at two other points in this conversation. Okay, and he said, the oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is open. Whose eye is open? Balaam's. Why is his eye open? Because he's talking to God. Okay, the oracle of him who hears the words of God. Who's that? Same person. It's Balaam, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down, yet seeing his eyes uncovered. How far are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, your valleys that stretch out like gardens? He's talking about the blessings that God is going to bring upon Israel. It's just exactly what Balak didn't want to know about. And we see in chapter 24, in verses 10 through 14, that Balak's anger burned against Balaam, and he struck his hands together, and Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have persisted in blessing them these three times. Then flee to your place now. I said I would honor you greatly, but behold, the Lord has held you back from honor. Did the Lord actually hold Balaam back from honor? How did the Lord honor him?
Held back from Balaam.
Yeah, he told him the truth. He told him what was going to happen. He gave him the ability to prophesy. He said, this is what you say, because this is what's going to happen. Excuse me. And so then in verses 15 through 25, Balaam really concludes the prophetic discourse that he has. And if you have read this, who gets destroyed? The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is open, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob. Who might that be? Could be Christ. A star came forth from Jacob, okay? And shall crush through the forehead of Moab. Who was it that crushed through the forehead of Moab that he's prophesying is going to happen? Who destroyed Moab? Same nation that destroyed Israel. Took them into captivity. Babylon, okay? Down in verse 22, nevertheless, Cain will be consumed. How long will Asher keep you captive? Who's Asher in this verse? Who must it be referring to that kept him captive? Babylon. It's got to be Babylon. Okay? Typically, Asher is used in the Old Testament to refer to Assyria, okay? But Assyria was actually, after they were initially destroyed, just a province of Babylon. And then we see in verse 25 of chapter 24 that Balaam and Balak go home. And in the beginning of chapter 25, the first three verses, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Why? Why did the Lord get upset with them? What's the number one commandment? You shall love the Lord your God with all your soul, heart, and all your soul. You shall have no other gods before him. Okay? And apparently, as will become obvious in a little while, where did they get this idea from that they could send the women out to tempt the Israelite men? Do you remember? Okay, we'll get there. Anyway, it went so far as the fact that have you ever thought about this? How many pagan religions, or can you think of a pagan religion that doesn't have sex as a matter of worship? Any pagan religions today that don't have sex as a matter of worship? We don't think about it that way. Not here. They knew what he did. I won't make a comment further on that. That's what we find they're doing here. When it talks about the fact that, behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent. Who's weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting? Who would be weeping? What would they be weeping about at the doorway of the tent of meeting? Only one thing that I know of. What have they just done? Verse 5. Moses said to the judge of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. How'd they join themselves to Baal of Peor? Yeah, it's one of those basic things that as human beings we have a significant amount of interest in, and we don't talk about a whole lot. I'm not certain why, but it's sex. That's how they knew. What's about to happen? One of them is going to do what? His name is Zimri, the son of Sain, a leader of his father's household among the Simeonites. What's he about to do?
Yeah.
I'm sorry? Well, he's going to die, but why is he going to die? Only because Phinehas, okay, stands up for God. Okay? The man and the woman were in a tent having sex, because when you have sex with this pagan religion, what are you doing? You're worshiping their God. You're worshiping their God. That's what they were doing, okay? And who knew about it? Moses knew about it, okay? The whole congregation knew about it. I believe that is in verse 25. And a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Okay, this is going on. Now, originally when I first started studying, I thought, well, they were doing this out in public and everybody was watching. No, that's not what it's talking about. They were in a tent. They were doing it in private. But the bottom line was everybody did know about it. And everybody, or at least it seems to me, a large number, okay, were weeping at the tent of meeting because of the sin that was going on in the camp of the Lord. And a large portion, a significant portion, okay, were participating in it. And that's what we see here. And then we see that Phinehas goes in. And what's the result of Phinehas killing these two people? What stops? A plague. God has already put a plague on Israel because of their joining to worship this pagan god. Okay? And 24,000 have died as a result of that. Okay? And we don't know how long it took for it, but it sounds like it was pretty rapidly that this happened. 24,000 people died, and we can read that in, and of course I can't find my verse 9, thank you. You know, that's a pretty good chunk of people. And apparently they died immediately. And you go down to verses 14 and 15, and the two individuals that were involved in this, Zimri and Cozbi, both of them are identified by God. Okay, and a result of this, what happens in the relationship between Israel and the Midianites? What does God say that Israel is supposed to do? Be hostile to them, verse 17, okay? And we're going to find out in just a little while what they do is they attack them and they kill them. Almost all of them. And then we see in chapter 26. In chapter 26, we're going to go through really quick. Chapter 26 is the second census, okay? And the second census is a census of the fighting men of Israel and then actually a third census of the Levites, because they weren't counted among the first census and among this census. Why was that? Why were they not counted? Because they didn't get what? I'm sorry?
Inheritance?
They did not get an inheritance. Well, they got an inheritance, okay? But the inheritance of the Levites was what? They got to be priests, okay? Their inheritance was God. Okay, that's what they got. But the first census and then the second census, okay, is the basis upon which the land of Canaan, the promised land, is going to be divided. And we see the second census, and we're going to go through this real quick, because what we see is that some of the tribes gained over this period of time that took place, and some of the tribes diminished. And you can go through, I can give you the numbers and all that, I have that written down, but what it matters, let's look at the total. Is it 51? I know it's in chapter 26. There we go, yes, verse 51, thank you. There are those who were these are those who were numbered of the sons of Israel, 601,730. And if you go back to Numbers 1, verses 45 through 46, you'll see that the number back there was 603,550. So they're down 1,820 fighting men. Because keep in mind, that's all that are being counted here, okay? The fighting men, 20 years old and upward, are the ones that are being counted and numbered here. And then in verse 52, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, among these, that is the 603,550, The land shall be divided for an inheritance according to the number of names. To the larger group you shall increase their inheritance, and to the smaller group you shall diminish their inheritance. And so God goes on through Moses to give the directions on how the land is to be divided up, okay? And then in verses 57 through 65, you have a numbering of the Levites. And it took me a while to figure out, because if you remember when we looked at it earlier in Numbers 3 and then in Numbers 4, there are two different numberings of the Levites. One of the numberings is for every male 1 month and older. And then the other numbering of the Levites is for 30 to 50, who are the ones that are actually doing the labor in and around supporting the tabernacle and keeping things going, the maintenance crew, so to speak. And so the ones that are participating in the worship, the ones that are involved in keeping that number in Numbers, the third chapter, verse 39, was 22,000. Here we find that it's 23,000 in verse 62. When they numbered them the second time, that's the same age group. It's the age group that is 1 month and older. Not the 30 years and older, but the 1 month and older. Okay, that's the group we're talking about in verse 62. Those who were numbered of them were 623,000, every male from a month old and upward. So they had, during this time period from the first numbering of the Levites to the second numbering of the Levites here, we find that they had an increase in their number within that age group of 1,000. But what's really interesting and maybe the most significant part of the 26th chapter is the last two verses of the chapter. Oh, let's go to the last three verses, starting in verse 63. These are those who were numbered by Moses and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. Verse 64, but among these there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron the priest. Where did Moses and Aaron number them? Yes. Numbers 3 at Mount Sinai. So that's referring back to the first numbering, okay? Who numbered the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai, for the Lord had said to them, they shall surely die in the wilderness, and not a man was left of them except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. What did you say? They're all died by when? Yes, before they could go into, apparently now, there's only three that are left alive. Who's the third one? Who hasn't died yet?
Moses.
Moses is the only one. Moses has not died yet, okay? He will shortly, but he hasn't died yet. So at this point in time, okay, Moses is left, Caleb is left, and Joshua, and all the rest of the sons who were counted in the first census have died. At least that's the way I interpret it. Now, if you want to disagree with me, that's fine. Yes, go ahead, Randy.
Well, it's all the ones that were over, what was it, 20 years of age?
Yes.
Yeah, all the ones that were younger than that.
Yes, the ones that were told they were not going into the promised land, okay, were 20 years and older, the ones that had been selected, okay, as warriors. Now, nope, that's all I can say. That's all the Lord says, okay?
Well, what'd he do with the women?
I have no idea. Doesn't tell us. Okay? Yeah, I can't you see them? No, never mind. I'm not going there. That's a non-political thing to say. And so When we get into chapters 27 through 30, it's interesting. How much time do I have?
10 minutes.
All right. I am proud of you, Rex. You got through four chapters at least. Chapters 27 through 30 really are instructions for the new generation, because that's going to be delivered, and that's what Deuteronomy is all about. Deuteronomy means number two, okay? When we get into Deuteronomy, we're not going to find many new laws. Where were all the laws delivered? Sinai, okay? And the laws that you're going to find here at the end of Numbers and in Deuteronomy, they're not new. Okay, they're repeat because what had just happened, according to what Moses told us in Numbers 26, whatever the verses were, 63 through 65, what had happened? They're all dead. Everybody else is dead. Okay, so it's these new ones, okay, that are now 20 years and over who will be fighting, okay? And they are the ones that will go into the promised land. So we start off, okay, with instructions of the new, for the new generation. And in chapter 27, verses 1 through 11, we run into a situation where a daughter of Manasseh, okay, daughter in the sense that she's in the tribe of Manasseh, but it wasn't a direct daughter. Okay, then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, came near, and these are the names of their daughters. And he gives the names of the five, 5 daughters. Okay, and their comment in verse 13 to Moses is, our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but he died of his own sin, and he had no sons. Okay, why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among his people? Because he had no sons. Give us a possession among our father's brothers. Okay, so if you don't have any sons, who's the first person the inheritance goes to? No. Up to this point anyway, it was the brothers. It went to the brothers, okay? And what he's saying, what they are saying is that our father died, he had no sons, and he had no brothers, okay? So let us have his inheritance. So what does Moses do? What should Moses have done? Oh, let me see. He talked to God. Okay? Isn't it amazing? You talk to God, you get an answer. What does God tell him? Verses 5. Okay? The daughters of Zelophehad, are right in their statements. You shall surely give them a hereditary possession. Why was it important to give them a hereditary? What are these laws of inheritance all about? What's the big deal? Who gets what? Where? Okay, in Canaan. Okay, when they divide it up, what does it matter? He who has the biggest gun gets the most property, right? He who has the most gold gets the most property. Chapter 26, verses 55 and 56. Where am I? 55 and 56. But the Lord shall, but the land shall be divided by how? Lot. Okay, lot. They shall receive their inheritance according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. According to selection by lot, their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller groups. Who controlled Lot? God did. So when the lands were divided up, who made the division? God made the division, okay? It wasn't a man, it wasn't Moses, okay? God was the one that by Lot controlled who got what. And in order to maintain that, He also gave them these laws of inheritance. Because the key to understanding the inheritance laws is to keep in mind that the intent of the laws was for the land to continue to remain in the same family and thus within the same tribe as it was originally divided by God. Yes, Kevin, go ahead.
Oh, chapter 27, verses 8-11,
yes.
Really gives you the rundown on all that.
Yes.
It's interesting. Diabolical way.
You mean they were trying to trick him? Oh. Okay. And we see in verses 12 through 14 what happens there. Go up to this mountain of Arabim and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. How much time had Moses spent directing the children of Israel?
40 years,
at least. If you think about back when they were, I mean, he spent a lot of time, dedicated a lot of time to Israel. Okay. Yes, Kevin, go ahead. Do you have a comment?
120 years, actually.
Yes.
So 40 years getting ready.
Okay, I'm gonna take one more minute and look at, make a note here so I'll know where to start next week. Chapter 27, verses 15 through 17. Moses appeals to Jehovah to appoint a leader in his place to shepherd the congregation. I thought that was really interesting, okay? It seems to me, based on his past experience with Israel and their leadership, he doesn't have a whole lot of confidence that they're going to make some good decisions about leadership. So he appeals to the only source that he has absolute confidence in. Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them and who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep which have no shepherd." And then we find in verses 18 through 21 of chapter 27, who does God pick? Joshua, okay? What does the name Joshua mean? God with us, Savior. It's a synonym for what? Jesus. It's a Hebrew synonym for Jesus. And so we see that's who leads the children of Israel into the promised land. And then next week we will continue with this section, which again is focused on what's going to happen when they go into the land.